Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Thank you, MOTAT. Now, I've got Marcus in studio with me, along with producer Sherry. How's it going, both of you?
Pretty good. How are you?
Good, yeah.
Yeah, great. Great. Let's talk about the first story. So the world's first living organism with fully redesigned DNA has been created.
That's right.
Do you want to explain what that means?
Yeah, I'll try. So these are researchers in the UK, in Cambridge, and they have taken some E. coli bacteria.
That's poo.
It's
related
bacteria
to poo.
From poo, from your gut. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Poo cells. Yes, poo cells. And they have altered the genome of that bacteria quite radically. So what they've done is they've replaced. So let me step back a little bit to try and explain this a bit better. A genome holds millions and millions of base pairs. So base pairs are molecules given out by the letters. Labeled with the letters G, A, T, and C. And they are aligned in a long, long, long line in DNA, mm-hmm. And that the order in which they're aligned is represents how proteins and other molecules are synthesized mm-hmm. in the DNA. Yep.
And ends up defining who we are.
Who we are. So the DNA itself is coiled up inside every cell. It holds all the instructions that the cells need to function. Mm-hmm. When the cells need more protein to grow, it reads the DNA that encodes that little bit of protein and makes the protein. DNA letters are read in trios, so called codons. A codon might be TCG or TCA or whatever, but they're just basically read in threes. Mm-hmm. Okay. Nearly all life on this planet, from jellyfish to humans to most other things, use 64 codons, so 64 groups of three-letter groups.
Right.
Yeah, but many of them do the same job. Okay, so there's redundancy in the system. Yeah, 61 of these three-letter groups, 61 of these codons make the 20 natural amino acids, and from these amino acids, proteins are built. So basically every protein that's in our bodies can be built from these amino acids.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the three remaining codons, the three main remaining three-letter groups, are effectively stop signs. They tell it when to stop reading the code. Yeah. What this team did, they wanted to redesign the genome of these E. coli bacteria by removing basically the redundancy, removing the superfluous groups of letters. They went through the DNA of these bacteria, and wherever they came across the letters TCG in that order, which makes the amino acid called serine, which is one of the standard amino acids, they replaced it as AGC, which does the same job. Okay. They did two more codons in a similar way, and so in total they made 18,000 as edits to the genome. That's a lot of changes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they removed every occurrence of the redundant three-letter groups and replaced them with others. This has only become possible in recent years because
gene editing
requires it requires us to naturally to artificially synthesize DNA.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you type in the code that you want, and you basically have a synthesizer that makes it. And it's only in recent years have you been able to make such long strands of DNA synthetically. It's synthesized, chemically synthesized, and piece by piece it's added to the E. coli and it replaced the organism's natural genome.
Wow.
Right? Poop is removed.
Oh, poop, sorry. My apologies.
Poop is gone. The bacteria from the poop.
Okay.
They clean them up.
Okay.
So what happened?
So basically, what you've done is created a new life form, because this is
a radically different
genetic code now.
But essentially, you've replaced it with things that do the same thing, though.
But
it
should do the same thing. So the question is, did it work? And the answer is pretty much yes. The bugs are slightly different. They are a little longer than normal. with this new genetic code, and they grow a little more slowly, but they do survive, and they are living, and they reproduce and do all of the things that bacteria do. And so the question is, why is this important?
Yeah, I was just going to say, why did they do this? What are they planning to use this technology on?
There are some benefits. So one benefit is not so obvious, because viruses are tuned to spread inside bacteria, and changing their DNA code could effectively make them virus resistant. And this is important because E. coli is used in the pharmaceutical industry to make insulin for diabetes and lots of other things, for cancer and multiple sclerosis and heart attacks and eye disease and all sorts of things. But entire production runs can be spoiled when the bacterial cultures are contaminated with viruses. And this happens.
Gotcha.
Yeah. This is like the first step, and it's by far the biggest organism that's been. It's not the first time this has been done, but it's by far the biggest, most radical change. And but it could be beaten fairly soon. So there's a group in Harvard that are building a synthetic genome for baker's yeast, and doing a similar sort of thing.
But that could be used to grow food.
To make maybe virus-resistant strains, or
right?
You could eat
grow virus-resistant, right?
Yeah.
So this is ultimately what they're trying to use it for, to be able to cancel out these.
I think so.
Viruses.
Yeah. And it proves that life can exist with this restricted genetic code. Yeah, because we've taken out sort of the redundancies here.
Yeah.
And it works. And I think they said it's not really surprising that the bacteria are a little bit different, because this is such a radical change.
Yeah.
There's probably unforeseen, you know, effects that they're still trying to figure out.
Yeah, surely that. I mean, we'd have to look at that long term as well.
Right.
Imagine if it was to a human. I don't know how I feel about
it. And then you think, well, is this now artificial life?
Mm.
Have we just made something that is not? I mean, it is not natural.
Mm.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Follow that one. All right. The next story is the physical kilogram is officially dead.
Yeah.
Now, I had a guess about this.
Okay.
Is this the representative kind of weight that we look at, and to say that's what a kilogram is? That's changed now.
That's gone.
It's gone. What do you mean it's gone?
Thrown it in the trash.
What?
Yeah,
why?
Thrown it in the garbage. Yeah. So. This happened 2 days ago, in fact. They have revised definitions for four fundamental basic scientific units. The kilogram, the Kelvin, which is temperature, ampere, amps, which is current, and the mole, which is a number, a quantity of atoms. They've all been revised.
Why?
Okay. And the reason is because the kilogram in particular was based on an object, that was based on a lump of platinum and iridium that was sitting in a vault in Paris, and the problem with that is that this little block of platinum and iridium would slowly wear and down a little bit. Some atoms would fall off, and the mass would change. No, seriously, you know, nothing stable.
Very
nothing
minor changes.
Very, very minor, but these
changes,
are very, very high precision. You know, we need these numbers to very, very high precision. So the idea is we want to divorce our definition of these units from some physical object.
Mm.
Yeah, separate them completely.
So how are they going to do that?
And so the kilogram in particular is derived through an experiment that makes use of a physical constant called Planck's constant. And what Planck's constant does, it's known to very, very high precision, but it relates the energy carried by a photon, just a little bundle of light, to its frequency, to the frequency of the photon. Okay, it's a fundamental constant. Physicists would tell you about it in much more detail than I can. What they've done is they've built an experiment, a device known as a Kibble balance. And I don't ask me to explain you how this works, but it generates an electromagnetic force that is balanced against a mass. And so for a known electromagnetic force, you can balance that and redefine this kilogram.
Wow.
So it's basically based on this Planck's constant, which is very, very well known.
So it's always going to be accurate constantly.
Yes, and it will never change. And it allows any lab with suitably precise equipment to define a kilogram from scratch.
Okay.
Right? So they don't have to...
Wherever they are.
Yes. So they don't have to go to Paris and, yep. and wear their little cotton gloves and
You'd
go in.
You'd think we would have like done this a little earlier.
well, I think I don't know whether the technology has been there to do it for many years.
Okay.
But they've been working on this for a while, so this has been planned for sort of over a long period.
Mm.
And it all came to the big change came, 2 days ago now?
Amazing.
Yeah.
This week. All right.
Yeah.
Lastly, measles. So this is about measles possibly erasing the immune system's memory.
Yeah, this is really interesting and
topical
certainly, because there's several outbreaks
in Auckland,
measles around
alone,
Auckland, especially
New Zealand.
Near where I live, which is the west side of Auckland. There are a lot of cases that have cropped up, and obviously there's this link with immunization and people not wanting to immunize their kids. But this is this report. Maybe it'll change some minds. I don't know, but. Normally when you get the measles, you know, you see the kids get rashes or adults sometimes horribly get rashes and it's painful and you get a fever and you get coughing and sore eyes and all sorts of things like that. But the real and that usually fades after a while. But the real harm from the virus is it attacks the immune system. Okay,
right.
And what it does, it silently wipes clean the immune system's memory of past infections. Okay, so you got a cold or you got a certain virus or whatever in when you were younger, and your immune system has a memory of that, and then when that virus comes along again or that bacterium comes along again, you can get rid of it quite efficiently.
Right.
But
I see where you're going.
If measles gets rid of that memory,
just
sort of an amnesia, immune system amnesia, it leaves people quite vulnerable to lots of other viruses and bacteria.
So not only measles.
All sorts of anything
all
else.
All sorts,
you know?
Right.
So it could be pneumonia, it could be ear infections, it could be something, diarrhea or something like that.
Right, so it attacks sort of the general immune system memory.
Right.
And it weakens that whole system. Whoa.
So it means the aftermath, the after effects from measles are probably worse
very
than... long lasting. And certainly not benign. This new view that people have come up with, this new view explains why measles vaccination creates a larger than expected sort of umbrella of safety. So wherever you induce measles vaccination, you always reduce childhood mortality. And it's not just childhood mortality from measles, it's childhood mortality from all of these other infections.
Wow.
And
I didn't know that.
And looking at the trends, you know, the immune system, once you've had measles, it might take months or years to bounce back from that, from this sort of memory loss. And, you know, in comparisons of health records, this is in the UK, but in comparisons of health records of children over this is a 25-year period, for up to 5 years after their bout of measles, children who had previously had the virus experienced more diagnosed infections than children who hadn't. Yeah? And the data is clear. Children who'd had measles were 15 to 24% more likely to receive a prescription for infection than children who'd never had measles. And when measles were rampant, children were more likely to die from other infections. Yeah.
So we've had somebody just text in now. Is that measles story based on any sort of credible science? Because it sounds like utter bullshit to me, they say. Could you somehow give the audience a link to the science he is referencing?
I can link to the paper. Actually, I don't think I have the link to the paper in here, but it is a published...
I can do that. I've got the link anyway in here, so I can find it during the ads. And listener, I'll make sure to let you know. Somebody else though asking, isn't 1 kilogram equal to 1 liter of water? I don't actually know that.
It depends on the temperature, depends on the pressure, not necessarily. It's close, but no.
Okay. Brilliant. All right, well, thank you, Marcus.
You're welcome.
We'll talk in 2 weeks.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.